This is an oral history interview with Farron Doss, Missoula, Montana, on July 13th, 1984, the Smoke Jumpers Oral History Project. Farron, I'd like to start the interview by asking what attracted you to smoke jumping?
Well, I think what originally attracted me to smoke jumping was being on the hot shots, being on the fire, and looking up and seeing the smoke jumpers, i.e. coming to the rescue. You know, that's always something that was appealing.
Oh, it's a hot shot.
That's the interregional fire crew, commonly known as ground pounders, etc.
Okay. Where did you do your training at for your smoke jumping?
Missoula, Montana.
What was your training like?
Heard a lot of rumors that it was going to be like the Army. Heard a lot of rumors that it was rather scary, you know, because of the stuff that you put you, that the trainers put you through. But looking back on it, it wasn't that bad at all. I almost got washed out because all new rookies have to go through what we call the monster dig and the pack out. The monster dig is approximately all night digging fire line. The following morning you put on 90 pounds, whatever, bushwhack cross country. And I had forgotten my wool socks, and all I had was silk socks. And I knew about it, but I didn't want to let anybody know because I would obviously got washed out right there. So I dug fire line all night long and packed out. And I think I was about 45 minutes late coming out of the woods. And about five of us were, as a matter of fact, four or five, got cussed out by the foreman. And at that time, I had taken my boots off and blood came out. I ripped it all the way up through the meat.
How long did your training last?
Training, 3-4 weeks. That included classroom training, training on the units, and I think 6 or 7 practice jumps.
What kind of things they teach in a classroom?
Chute handling, graphic exit procedures from the aircraft, operation of chainsaws, cross cuts, helicopter procedures, etc. First aid.
How many guys did you train with?
I want to say something around 27, I think, maybe.
You know how many of them washed out?
4 or 5, maybe. For many reasons. Some couldn't pass the PT. Some decided they didn't like jumping after their 5th or 6th jump.
Were you stationed at the base during the training?
Yes, Missoula.
So you lived on the base and you worked?
No,
on the
I lived in town.
Okay.
And went to the base every day.
You remember when you made your first jump?
Beg your pardon?
Do you remember your first jump?
Oh, yes.
And when was it?
I don't remember the date.
Okay.
But I remember what it was like. They teach you to exit the aircraft with a lot of vigor. You know, they say 1 foot up, 3 feet out. And you practice in the shock tower because you want to get away from the aircraft when you jump. But the first jump, all I remember was kind of tippy-toeing out the airplane on DC-3.
What did you feel when you were standing right there at the door ready to go out?
The truth?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
What about your first fire jump?
First fire jump was in Winthrop, out of Winthrop Smoke Jumper Center in Washington. The day before, we turned down a jump because we were going to jump on a ridge with three-sided cliffs all the way around. And the squad leader in charge, Bill Yant, as a matter of fact, said, "Don't jump it." I would have gone out because I wouldn't have known any better, but we said no. And then the following day, we had a better fire up on another ridge top, and that was my first fire jump. He got his ankle broken, and that ended his career. And I had a tree landing and oscillated and got my helmet knocked off.
Can you explain to me what oscillating is?
The canopy landed in the tree, but I was at such an angle that when it finally caught the tree, what it did is just swung me just like on a regular swing, and it just slammed me into the trunk.
How many guys jumped that fire?
Two.
How long did it take you to fight the fire?
Okay, what happened was he was unable to fight the fire. I took his boots off to look at his feet, and there was something obviously wrong with it. He thought it was broke, so we radioed for a helicopter, and a helicopter came and did something illegal. It was definitely an unsafe area because he couldn't land safely. At the time that he touched down one skid on the ground, he had another skid hanging over the cliff, and he just balanced. And I think there were trees probably 2 feet all the way around from his rotary blades. Yeah. And I was talking with the pilot on radio because he circled in and told me what he was going to do. And we had Bill Yant. God, it was hurt right there. So when he nodded his head, the door was open, and I threw him in. And he just revved it up and just tipped it over the cliff and went. And they replaced Bill with about, first of all, two women. And then they brought up some other people. And I got helicoptered off the fire just before evening. Otherwise, I'd have had to pack up, and they said that they would prefer having their own people on it.
Why were you in Winthrop?
Fire activity was high over there, and people from Missoula got shipped over there. Normally, that's what happens, the region or the base or the geographical area that has the most fire activity. Of course, they'll use their own jumpers first, but when they get out of those jumpers, then they'll call for other people, and that's how we got over there.
So how many different bases have you been to?
My first season, I hit them all but two. I think I hit LeGrand, Redding, Redmond, set up a spike base at Fresno. We never did jump. We just stayed in a hotel for 3 days. And Winthrop. Those were the areas, yeah.
How did you feel about being shuttled around from base to base?
It was great. I think most jumpers, especially their first year, they're looking forward to it, to see the country, you know, the spectacular sights and everything. Everybody wants to travel around a lot. I had no remorse at all about traveling. It was great the first year.
What did you get any reactions or feelings from your friends when you told them you were going to become a smoke jumper?
My close friends didn't believe me, and I didn't really believe myself. I've always wanted to jump out of an airplane. I used to always sit on campus and watch the Silver Tips, the skydivers. And I paid my money a couple times, but never jumped, always got it back, always copped a plea and said I didn't want to do it. And when I applied for smoke jumping, I applied for it as my first choice, knowing that I wouldn't get it. I thought I was going to get Helitech, because that's where all my real close friends were, on Helitech. And then I got selected, then it was kind of shit or get off the pot.
What about your mom? What'd she say when you told her you were going to jump?
My mom has always told me that I was crazy, and I was always the one that was on the brink of doing something dangerous. So she wasn't really surprised. She didn't want me to do it. But after I showed her pictures and everything, then she understood a little bit. You know, mom's fear is always going to be there.
Mm-hmm. You ever see any guys make mistakes during training?
What do you mean, mistakes?
Mistake on the shock tower.
Yeah. You know, because everything is so new. You're learning. Mm-hmm. A couple guys, including me, couldn't jump out of the tower properly. Some of us just kind of fell out and bounced off the side, whatever. Landing simulators, learning how to do the parachute landing on PLF. Everything that you learn that you do for the first time, you make a lot of mistakes. But in live action, you can't afford to make too many of them, because that's where you get busted up.
How many jumps did you make that first year that you jumped?
Including training, I would say 11 or 12. I'm not really sure. They've got records on it all. But I would say maybe 11 or 12.
What year was this?
1977.
How do you feel about having to do project work?
Project work. My first year, we didn't really do a whole heck of a lot because of the fire activity was really high and we were always on the move. The project work that I was involved with was project work right at the Area Fire Depot. Second year, when we started going to other bases, some of the project work I thought was Mickey Mouse. Busy work. But that's the dues you pay. When people from out of region or out from other bases came to Missoula, we had high, busy kind of work for them too. It's expected when you're not fighting fires that you're doing something, either fire preparedness or assisting districts in accomplishing some of their programs.
Have you ever seen anybody that really objected strongly to project work?
Yeah. Yep. And did a lot of complaining, and ultimately the complaining caught up to him. Meaning, the spirit, the core of the jumpers is really tight, and everybody realizes, hey, we don't have any choice in doing these kind of things, we gotta do them. And the ones who refused to do them kind of stood out, and sooner or later they either quit or they found other work, or they screwed up and IE management caught up to them.
You think it's harder than it should be to fire someone who's not pulling his weight in the Smoke Jumpers organization?
Do I think it's? No. And I say that because I'm in management now. People who aren't pulling their weight, not artificial weight, but realistic weight, management has gotten rid of them based upon their need to have a strong workforce and not a weak workforce. And those that could not pull their weight, they needed to go down the road. And I say strong weight versus weak weight because the Smoke Jumper unit historically has a, what I would call, an unrealistic operational level. You know, you have to be 6'6", 250, body built like the Hulk. And that's not necessarily true.
Isn't the work so physically demanding that you need to be that size?
No. No. I weighed 160, I think. And there were people smaller than me that worked harder than I, and there were people a hell of a lot larger than me that I could work circles around. We tend to live in a myth. And we've perpetuated that myth over time. And I think that's the problem we're in today. With the changing of the X-118 qualification standards, et cetera, et cetera. Things are changing. And I think ultimately the workforce will be where it should have been years ago. That's one of my sore points.
What about letting women in the Smoke Jumpers? Did that in any way ruin the help?
I think if you talk to old-timers who are hung up in the Marine mentality, and I say that, you know, not too negatively, it was a shock for them to all of a sudden, good old boy syndrome was being taken away. You know, if I was a good old boy, it would be real easy for me to pass the word to management to get Frank or Joe or Sam, you know, another good old boy. But once you start infiltrating into the workforce, new people, it's very difficult for a lot of people, as it was to allow blacks to smoke jump. When I was jumping, I was the only one in the nation.
I want to ask you about that. Did you experience any adverse reactions when you decided you wanted to become a jumper?
I'll put it this way. I can only assume, you know, because these interviews and what other people will bring out the truth, maybe. But I can only assume that the majority of the workforce that was there when I trained was liberal enough to allow equal opportunity. You know, they were just as hard on me, I feel, as they were everybody else.
You feel that the civil rights movement in the 70s might have anything to do with that?
Civil rights. I think so, because of the fact that exposure always, in a cyclic pattern, opens up avenues. When I finally, I graduated from rookie training, I was watched pretty heavily. And I'm sure I was talked about in circles of maybe being marginal and this and that, but I didn't allow it to bother me. When I went to other bases, there were also jumpers who could not relate, that would say, what, you know, the expression, what in the hell are you doing here, that kind of an attitude. But because of the whole intermix of smoke jumping, if they don't like you, they'll leave you alone. You know, they won't bother you. Sometimes they'll make remarks on your work ethic and all that kind of stuff based upon stereotypes. But I never had any super adverse statements made towards me as being a black, because the rest of the guys were taken care of, because they don't, you know, they don't deal with that kind of stuff. Irregardless, once you make the meet, i.e. once you become a smoke jumper, you're a smoke jumper. And you're in the fraternity, i.e. sorority, and guys will defend you to the max.
Did you ever see any women have any problems?
Because of when they went through training?
Yeah, just because they were women.
I can't really answer that. I can presuppose that they had problems, as I can presuppose that I had minor problems. And the problem is winning acceptance, losing your IE identity so that you can be part of the overall workforce. You know, they don't want to be treated any different. I didn't want to be treated any different. But there are circumstances that you can't escape. You are different. And those who say that, no, they were, Farron was just one of the guys, or Jane was just one of the gals, in theory and practice maybe, minimally, but in reality, no, that's horse crap. They had to fight for, we have had to fight for everything that we got. Had to produce extra, i.e. just to gain that acceptance.
What do you feel about this concept of smoke jumping become a profession instead of just a summer job for college?
It's a heated issue because I'm in management now. It started off with being a summer job. Over time, we have allowed people to become career, you know, career conditionals, which has opened up a lot of avenues for those who wanted to make this a career. Without being allowed to get that type of career, I wouldn't be here now in my position that I have. So I guess I'll answer that on both sides of the coin. I think the majority of the work on a calendar year for smoke jumping, and the majority of the total smoke jumper workforce, is temporary, meaning 3 months out of the year. I think there are very few openings for people who work longer than 3 months, but we've got everybody in this bottle and they're getting stuck in the neck trying to get out, and there are very few opportunities to get out. I feel that those who want to stay in smoke jumping as i.e. a career should be allowed that opportunity without too much adverse promotion on management to get rid of them. But I think as we begin to think of where we're going realistically, I think we need to allow that pendulum to come back to a temporary workforce. In other words, as career people or career conditional employees begin to leave, find other work, I think we should decrease the amount of career conditional appointments and allow those people to, i.e., get into the system that have the stated objective to become a career employee. There are very few people who are doing this just on a temporary basis.
You feel that kind of makes organizations stagnate if you have a large group of people that want to make this into a career?
I think any time you play a game and you're not allowed to experiment with new ideas, you become stagnant. But what I have seen here, which I haven't seen in the private industry, is that the strengths of the smoke jumpers are varied. I mean, there's so much talent out there at the Missoula base, it's almost pathetic. You know, we've got lawyers, people who are doctors, people who are in politics, we've got carpenters, plumbers, you name, electricians, you name it. You know, that's the pool of professionalism we have out there, and that is great. They're doing this because they like it and they enjoy it, but they could just as well get out and do something else.
How do you feel about the foresters using private contractors to fly smoke jumpers?
Oh, we always kid about that. At times I say, well, if we could get enough smoke jumper management, i.e. foremen, squad leaders involved with the planning process, it could be advantageous because of the things that they want and have not been able to obtain because of the times, you know, budgetary times. But then I guess I'd hate to see a dying tradition go from private industry, because there are some of the people who are working for the agency that would not get the same opportunity to work in private industry, because that's just how it works. The person who has let the contract tends to have a pool of friends, and those people are going to be absorbed into the work environment. Those who are kind of on the perimeter are going to be excluded.
You feel that there's too much bureaucracy in the smoke jump organization?
I think there's too much bureaucracy, period, point blank. But I think a lot of the bureaucracy we have going at the AFD, the majority of it is necessary, based upon the entire needs of the agency versus the needs of those jumpers that are exposed to, you know, the frustrations they have to live with. They're only part of the entire picture, and people who are functioning at the confines of the AFD think the majority of them only in terms of thyself and thy small group versus what are we really doing for the AFD.
Do you feel that this bureaucracy has in any way at any one time hurt that whole picture of smoke jumping?
I would think that the old timers would probably say yes, because the spirit of corps is different than it used to be, and the Marine image is gone, and the, you know, the John Wayne here I come dun 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 is gone. But I think the whole role of smoke jumping has changed. I think the whole methodology of attacking fires and becoming a working unit has changed.
Has it changed since you started?
Sure. I think right now that we are a dying species. I think the forests nationwide are beginning to realize that maybe they don't really need smoke jumpers. They're expensive as hell to get them up there from planes. There are more and more roads. There are more and more, i.e. let burn geographical areas. So the web is getting tighter and tighter.
Is it possible smoke jumpers go the way of the dinosaurs?
I think it's very realistic. Yes. Based only upon what I'm seeing coming down the tube with management. I think, say, the Washington office, a management here, will do everything in their power to their last dying breath to fight for jumping, because jumping is empire. You know, it's in the hearts of America, at least the people that are exposed to jumping. But I think realistically, over time, it's probably going to be a dying breed. The numbers are already starting to decrease. Bases have already shut down. People have been relocated to other places. And I think in time, or even at our AFDs, we're going to be down possibly, we're going to give up 20 slots maybe next year. That's only the beginning, yeah.
Here in Missouri?
Yeah. I mean, we're not going to get rid of 20 people, but as we believe, we will not fill those slots. At least that's the latest talk of the management circles.
Is there a lot of scuttlebutt like that go around the office out there?
At management meetings, yeah, because of the pressure that's being put upon us, placed upon us, because of budgetary situations.
What kind of a management job do you hold right now?
I'm the, today was my last day, personnel officer and the administrative officer. I was going to hold down both jobs for the last, the administrative officer for the last 3 months, and the personnel officer for the last year and 3 months.
Is there a difference in ideology between the administration and the jumpers themselves?
Oh, most definitely. know, like that's what I was trying to say before. Mm-hmm. Management, at times, right, wrong, or indifferent, appears to be functioning with the total picture, and the jumpers are just thinking, jumping, overtime, fires, good deals, et cetera, et cetera. And at times, management looks through their glasses and they're not looking at it realistically and in focus.
Kind of like change the stream of thought right here. Okay. Go back to the jumping aspects.
All right.
When you step out of the plane,
right,
you're coming down the ground, what are you thinking about?
Is this the spot that I really, really want? And am I set for the impact?
How hard is the impact?
Sometimes it's like stepping in a sack of marshmallows. Other times it's like free falling and landing on your stomach. It depends on the last few minutes of the ground. You know, if you're getting some down air or you've done something wrong to force that chute to make you land harder. Or if you're running with the wind, you know, you're supposed to land facing the wind. And yours truly used to always do just the opposite. So I hit the ground hard a whole bunch of times before I finally saw the light.
How do you guide a chute when you're coming down?
There's toggles on both sides. And toggles are basically two small pieces of wood attached to the cord. And if you pull right, you're going to go right. If you pull left, you're going to go left on the new chute. And pull your brakes down to the left, you can stop the forward speed and back, yeah. So you're just quarter turning, completely turning, or whatever, just to kind of set yourself up to get to the right spot.
What kind of gear would you have on your person as you made a jump?
Smoke jumping gear?
Mm-hmm.
I have a jumpsuit with quarter inch Insulite around the neck, knees, shoulders, groin area, protect you from impact. Mm-hmm. And then a PG bag in the front. PG bag is that little small orange bag that everybody wears with working gear in it, camera, whatever. And of course the helmet with the mesh screen and gloves.
What's the first thing you do after you hit the ground?
Yell out your name and say you're okay, and if you're not, tell if you busted up. The first thing is safety. You want to make sure that you're all right and everybody else is all right. Get out of your gear and check on your partners. Then, put on the double L system, which means everything okay, and then the plane will come back and drop your cargo, and then you retrieve the cargo and go to work.
Let's back up to the double L system here. What's...
It's like long crepe paper, bright orange paper. Worth paper like material, and we've got a system of codes because sometimes you don't have a radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to, the plane will not leave unless you put out some type of communication that you're all right, because there's people in the plane most oftentimes that will jump and rescue if you're hurt, so they want to make sure that you're all right. So you put out the L saying you're all right.
How does the spotter let you know when you're approaching the jump site?
Normally, his head is out the door. You're set up in the door, and they would have already thrown out the streamers, see where the wind is going, etc. On the live jump, his head is out, and he's coming up to the point of exit the same way he did during the test run. And when he's ready to tell you to jump out, he'll get out of the way and slap you. Sometimes real hard, sometimes you're not even sure if you tap, you just jump out. But you're in the door looking at the smoke yourself.
How close are you usually to fire when you land?
It depends. Sometimes right within it, depending on the size of the fire. Sometimes if it's a gobbler, they will let you out at the most safe place.
What's a gobbler?
Fire going like hell.
Is there any one jump that sticks out in your mind as being the most memorable jump you made?
I've got a bunch of them.
Care to tell me about one of them or two of them?
Okay. I think the most memorable jump was the experience in Alaska. Jumping. Everybody said that the world is a jump spot, and they're not lying. there's just land for days up there. It's pretty flat, at least where we jumped in. It's landing in the tundra. You're prepared for the shock, like landing on the ground in the lower 48. And up there, it's just like marshmallow. You're just kind of in a marsh, just boom. It was really soft. So soft, it scared me. It was so nice.
What kind of a fire would you fight up there?
Tundra fire. And you fight it entirely different. You grab potato sacks, gunny sacks, put a couple handfuls of mud in them, and get them wet, then you walk around the fire beating it out. One in each hand. I thought that was really strange, but it works. In fact, when I first did it, I didn't know how to do it. And they just said, fill up the deal with mud and moss and that. I filled it about 3/4 way, and I couldn't pick both of them up, so I just had one, and I was just beating it. And everybody in the whole fire just kind of cracked up, and they said, no, dummy, you're going to kill yourself. Just take it all out and beat it. So.
You made a lot of jumps in Alaska?
Nope. I made one jump in Alaska, and came home. We were on the fire for, I think, 3 or 4 days. They couldn't get us out because of the low overcast, ran out of food, water, and then it snowed, and that whole deal. And prior to that, jumped in the bob.
What's it like jumping in the bob?
That was a rough jump. I hit a small tree and got dung up a little bit. Just got the wind knocked out of me. But we had a super fire. I think there were 6 of us. A quarter acre fire. Had a creek right up above the fire that was coming out of the hill. We dug fire lines and then dug channels down through the fire. And diverted the creek and drowned the fire. And then I got hurt on the next turn.
What happened?
I think we jumped 60 people down the middle fork of the sand. And I hit the ground okay, and we were mopping up. Or I should say, trying to dig fire lines, because this thing was going like crazy. And one of my buddies, Wayne, was using a chainsaw and didn't have a spotter. I don't know why, but I guess everybody was busy doing something else, and somebody from the hot shot, he kicked a log loose, and the log came down the hill and split about a 50-pound section. Nailed him in the back of his head when he stood up. And I was the closest one to him. I just got my EMT card, and I thought I was going to do my first rescue. And I went running down the hill after him, and took out my knee, and he got knocked out. But he was fine. He walked off the hill, and they put me in a stretcher. And that ended my career.
Is that the only time you ever got hurt?
Unfortunately not. Twisted ankle. Seemed like I was always dung up for some reason or another. I think I'll probably go down in the history book as being one of the jumpers that was always ailing from something. Something always went wrong. You know, a lot of guys got hurt and they wouldn't report it, which was part of the ethics. Well, he said if he got hurt, fill out a CA-1, so I did. That seemed like every year something went wrong. Progressively worse until the end.
Were there any fatalities while you were jumping?
No.
Not in Missoula, but in bases other...
Smoke jumping fatalities?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe so. But had a buddy that came close. Hit a tree. In Region 5, I think, and fell about 5 stories through the tree on his stomach. Broke his sternum and everything else. They took him to the hospital, opened him up. He came back the next year more John Wayne-ish than ever before, but he's not jumping anymore.
How do you feel about the safety record as the organization as a whole?
I think it's excellent. Based upon the number of jumps and the difficult terrain that we're in. Injuries come with the job. I think parachute injuries have been lessened a whole hell of a lot from what I'm understanding because of the I think it's called the anti-inversion webbing, the little square netting that's on the bottom of all the parachutes now. There's not too many malfunctions. Well, there's not any malfunctions. And I guess I was told prior to that time they were always malfunctioning one way or
the other. When did they come out with this little...
When?
Yeah.
I have no idea. It was before my time.
You ever have any of the guys that jumped for a long time come up and tell you stories about what it was like back in the old days?
Oh, yeah. And even within my own range, we always sit and tell war stories. But you can't even compete with the old guys. I mean, they will sit just like professional storytellers and keep you in awe. Hal Sampson. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll make you cry with laughter for some of the stories that he has to tell you.
Is that pretty common for you guys to get together and sit around and shoot the breeze?
Yeah, and I think Smoke Jumpers are known nationwide as working hard, partying hard, and swapping stories hard.
Do you feel that there's an abnormally high rate of alcoholism among Smoke Jumpers?
Wow. I feel this is a John Harper question. yes. But no higher than the rest of the workforce. The difference being, we've got a particular breed of people here that work hard and party hard. You know, I have a hard time differentiating between that type of partying and social cocktail hours with dressing and tie. But I think our workforce, we have a lot of people who are at the brink of losing it because of alcohol. That's unfortunate. And it bothers me.
Did you ever know any jumpers that carried a good luck piece with them while they jumped?
Good luck?
Yeah. Superstitious people.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of guys that wear these brass bracelets. You know, and from what I'm told, they have powers and give them good luck. Other guys carry metal flasks for good luck. But I don't think it's something that you see in the Audie Murphy type movies, you know, mm-hmm. Rabbit foot strapped on the coat and that kind of stuff. Yeah. What Smoke Jumpers carry is a little small 3x5 notebook. That's their luck. That's where they tally their overtime.
What do you put in your little logbook?
Time of jump, name of fire, hours worked, and a separate sheet for hours of overtime. So you can compare overtime war stories at the end of the season.
I've heard these called by another name. They're called lie books. Is that pretty accurate?
Lie books? I've never heard that before. I think the majority of the time is turned in fairly accurate. I sincerely believe that. I never kept my time in my book. I used to always write fragments of sentences and notes what I was thinking when I was digging fire lines to keep my mind off the work. In fact, I've written a book from it. Live books. That's the first time I heard that. That's probably from one of the old timers.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, one other thing I want to ask about is during the off season, what do a lot of jumpers do with themselves?
Okay. They make a lot of money. A lot of them that are unattached, meaning no relations, travel around the world. Some teach. Some go back to law practice. A lot of them go back to school. A lot of them try to get on with Forest Service units, you know, late work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them collect unemployment.
You feel Alaska will become the last stronghold of the Smoke Jumpers?
Alaska?
Yeah.
No, I think the lower 48 will.
Why is that?
I think there's more of us down here. And I think we've got more of a historical presence here than in Alaska. People remember the lower 48 as having Smoke Jumpers. And I think that management will fight a hell of a lot harder to keep something going in lower 48 than up north, even though the two different systems, the BLM versus the Forest Service.
Wouldn't the need be greater in Alaska than the lower 48 in years to come?
I don't think I can answer that intelligently. I would just say no, without nothing to support it.
Well, I think I've about exhausted my list of questions. Is there anything that you feel that I missed? That maybe something you want to add, or?
Yeah, I guess something that bothers me. I think it bothers me from my own presence. I've been concerned that with the opening of the doors, employment doors for women and minorities, they're being absorbed into the system under the concept of the good old boy syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel that they're really getting their due. Good example is the AFD has thousands of people that come through every year. 15 to 20,000 maybe. That's high. People from all backgrounds, from all across the country and even world, and they're exposed to a basically white organization. You know, there are no pictures there of anybody of color, nor of other gender, except for them. In fact, John and I have talked at this some length because I even the books that are out. Speak nothing of it. The latest was Stan Cohen. Stan and I talked many times. Hey, Stan, where's your women representation here, picture-wise? Or where do you speak that? How many blacks have gone through the organization? Because there are black people that come through, and the first thing you do is they see a black on project work where they say, well, look, you know, he's not a jumper or she's not a jumper. They're hired help. So, and that bothers me.
Yeah. I think that's going to change?
No. It's not going to change until management is sensitized to that and somebody takes the lead to do it.
Will it happen under the current management, or will it have to happen as the changing of the guard?
It will happen under current management if management is exposed to the need. And I think they haven't really truly been. I seem to be maybe the only one that's really getting into it right now. I think John Harper's in a damn good position to do something if he wants to. There's basement full of pictures, past, present, and I think they need to incorporate some of that stuff down there so that the general public can see that.
You ever get the feeling that maybe you're being a thorn in the side of the administration and that they don't want you to be doing these things?
Oh, no. Not our people there. And I don't think not our people in the Washington office, because they're the ones who have exposed us to the changing of the critical work performance. You know, to meet certain criteria to work, they've been changed, they've been lessened. So I don't think that they're wanting to hide it at all. But business as usual will always go business as usual unless somebody takes the one and changes it.
Well, I can't think of anything else. We've touched just about everything that I wanted to touch.
Good.
Say thanks for the interview.
You betcha.